Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 20th of April. Monday at 9 is All Things Political, and our guest this hour is Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. We'll be talking about President Obama's Latin America trip, Hugo Chavez, a changed policy perhaps on Cuba. We will look at Iran and the American journalist who's been jailed for spying in Iran and how the administration handles that. This week is Earth Day. We'll talk about credit card practices and the first meeting of the cabinet. Obama's cabinet is taking place today, and he's going to be asking department and agency chiefs to look for ways over the next 90 days to cut $100 million out of the federal budget. We'll also be talking about piracy and how to handle that and much more on the agenda. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And we do have our email up and running now, so the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. Professor David Michael Green, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great to be back with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Let's start with Cuba, if you don't mind, where the president ordered last week the easing of travel limits to Cuba by Cuban Americans and also sending their money. They can send as much money as they want to family members who live in Cuba and American companies providing telecommunications links to Cuba. Is this a big change or just the beginning of what may be a big change?
Yeah, I think that's the $64,000 question. And I think that's really, I think, the question that applies to so much of figuring out who Barack Obama is as president of the United States. I mean, I think that I guess I should speak for myself, but I imagine this is true of a lot of other analysts and citizens. It's still a little bit of an open book, or even a lot, trying to figure out what kind of president he's going to be. And every day we get, and frankly, quite a lot of new data points. And so, you know, we can sort of begin to chart the direction of this presidency. And I would say that's really the fundamental question, the one that you asked. Is he taking small steps and that will be the end of it, in which case he's going to be sort of a very kind of centrist president with moderate kind of initiatives? Or is he an incrementalist who will continue to take smaller steps, building on the prior smaller steps, and ultimately get to the point where, you know, 4 years or 8 years down the road, he's made a very large change indeed? I just don't think we know quite yet.
Mm-hmm. The New York Times, I'm sure you saw, had an interesting piece in the front page yesterday pointing to just that, saying that he's well-known for bold proposals that have raised expectations, but his young administration, and I quote, has shown a tendency for compromise and caution, even a willingness to capitulate on some of his early initiatives.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think what you see with Obama, if you want to think about this in ideological terms, is some disappointment from the left and some obvious hostility from the right. And so, you know, that suggests to me that he's kind of, so far at least, a moderate president. But I think what we really don't know is, you know, we're not even at 100 days yet. So, again, it could be very much the case, and I think this would fit with his style and personality, although I don't think we know that this is how it'll turn out, but it could be very much the case that he wants to get a very far distance at the end of the day, but he doesn't want to do it all at once, and so he wants to kind of lead and bring the country along bit by bit. And if that's your approach, then you take small steps now and you compromise here where you have to. And as I said, 4 years down the road or 8 years down the road, you might have, in fact, realized a lot of change without necessarily alienating a lot of people in the process by taking wholesale leaps, or without necessarily endangering your agenda by, you know, creating very big enemies with some sort of giant initiative. So I just don't think we know whether he ultimately will continue to take these small steps, or this is kind of it, you know, what we're seeing now.
He certainly, Professor Green, has moved on so many fronts, and he's been all over the world.
Yeah.
What a schedule.
That's incredible. I mean, I have to say that he has already, in a short amount of time, traveled a fair bit, but also just kind of opened up on the foreign policy front, as well as the domestic policy front, really opened up a lot of initiatives. But, you know, I think the proper way to understand this, Kathleen, is that if you just understand that the last 8 years, it seems to me, was really an aberration. And Obama, in many ways, I think, is just kind of a return to form, a little bit more than that, but primarily that. And so basically, I think what's going on here, I mean, the central explanation for why you see so much activity in so many places, the way I would characterize it, is that history was sort of marching in one direction over the last 8 years. The Bush administration, on policy front after policy front, was marching in the opposite direction. And Obama, by coming in and sort of restoring, you know, that historical arc to where it would have gone had you had, say, another, just for example, another 8 years of Bill Clinton-like president, for example, by sort of returning to that basic general direction, represents a huge departure, again, on policy front after policy front, from the Bush administration. And he's in some ways just, I think, resolving that enormous tension that was building up over time between the direction that, you know, that history was marching and the opposite direction that the Bush administration was going. So what I'm trying to say is that he looks like he's doing huge number of things, but in fact, it's really, I really think it's more the Bush administration that was the aberration than the Obama administration that's doing so much that's so new and extraordinary. But you're quite right. I mean, you can't deny that a huge amount of things are happening on many, many fronts right mm-hmm. now.
This week we celebrate Earth Day, and the EPA had an interesting ruling last week. Is it going to result in really significant changes in terms of the kinds of cars we can buy and the way that companies will be operating in terms of emissions, et cetera?
Well, it may. And actually that decision may be swamped ultimately by congressional action, which I gather is what the administration would prefer. But the genesis of this is that the Clean Air, there was a lawsuit under the provisions of the Clean Air Act, and the Supreme Court, in fact, ordered the then Bush administration to respond to this lawsuit, and which was claiming that there are about six gases, including CO2, which clearly were being shown to harm health. And so under the provisions of the Clean Air Act, then the EPA was supposed to be able to regulate the emission of those gases. And what happened under the Bush administration, and this is perhaps a really good example of what I was just trying to argue, was that you had the entire, almost the entire scientific community within the EPA saying, yes, of course, you know, the evidence is really clear now that there's a great deal of harm coming from these emissions. But then they were blocked and overruled by the political elites in the EPA and in the Bush administration, and so nothing happened. And so this is, again, a really good example of what I was talking about. Obama walks in the door, and basically all he does is, you know, undoes what the Bush people were doing, kind of blocking the natural direction of things, I guess I would argue. And so that's what you have now. The EPA is now stating that, in fact, these are harmful gases and they are subject to regulation. But I do think that they would rather see Congress come up with a cap and trade system instead that would render the EPA's role in this superfluous, I think.
Mm-hmm. So who'd have thought open veins of Latin America, 5 centuries of the pillage of a continent would be number 2 on Amazon this week, huh?
Yeah, I mean, these are sort of amazing changes. I mean, I don't know where we're going to go with Cuba, for example, which is the biggest change. And then you also have the handshake, if you will, with Hugo Chavez from Venezuela. And probably everybody in the world has seen that picture of both of those two gentlemen with big smiles on their faces. And, you know, boy, if a picture represents 1,000 words, that was a case. And I don't think it represents any giant policy leap right at the moment, but what it represents is a willingness to go down a path, a willingness to listen, a willingness to stop demonizing, perhaps, a willingness to fall into the fold where the rest of the international community is, and perhaps an ability to detoxify a relationship that in some ways was I think, very personal as much as anything. So you have both, I think, on the Venezuela front and the Cuba front, the possibility of really big changes between those two countries and their relations with the United States. In fact, already they've started, actually, on both fronts. You've already seen real momentum, not just rhetoric. So it's a pretty big thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about pirates in Somalia and also about terrorism in Somalia as well. It was quite a week. The captain made his way home over the weekend, and yet we are getting reports of pirate attacks still taking place of a country there that is a mess and that may be breeding terrorism. Is this going to be a big issue for this administration and for the world to deal with in the coming months?
That's a good question. I suspect not. I mean, I don't think the piracy is going to go away. It may even be exacerbated, but I do think that there probably are solutions to it. And, you know, when you say big issue, I tend to think of, you know, 9/11 or the Cold War or maybe Vietnam or something on that scale in terms of a truly big foreign policy issue. And so this, I think, will probably be an annoyance, but I suspect there are military or other sorts of solutions to the actual piracy. Of course, many people believe that what really fuels the piracy, and you alluded to this, Kathleen, is the failure of the Somalia state, and Somalia is really sort of, in many ways, the world's ultimate failed state. So that you basically have political chaos within the borders. There isn't really a ruling government to speak of, and there's extreme poverty and deprivation, and so many people believe that that's really what's fueling the piracy. If you wanted to look for deeper solutions then to the problem, then perhaps there would be a way to address that poverty and also that political chaos. And of course, the United States has had some bad experience dipping its toe into that pool a little bit in the past, and I don't expect there would be huge initiatives in that respect. But even if the piracy continues, even if it were, say, to double in the coming months and years, I think that would be clearly a problem and clearly an annoyance, maybe even a big annoyance. But I guess I wouldn't want to describe it as a big problem for American foreign policy.
We go to phone calls in just a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 20th of April. Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University, is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. And the email address, feel free to use that if you can't get through on the phone, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, inspired by the Susan Boyle story, we will talk about late bloomers. All right, let's go to your phone calls. And Rick from La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen. It's great to hear you again. Mr. Green, I have so much to say, but what I was puzzled about was that nowhere in the American press was there any mention of the significance of Las Venas Abiertas de America Latina, which was published in 1970, Open Veins of Latin America. It was written by a journalist who was imprisoned in the dungeons of Bortaberry in Uruguay, a regime the U.S. supported, just as it did likewise all right-wing dictatorships in the 1970s, and a regime that, you know, they even haven't had a U.S. operative in Uruguay that advised Uruguay's police on how to torture. So torture didn't begin in Abu Ghraib. Who would have thunk? And the point that I'm trying to get at is why is it that the U.S. press just didn't get into the significance of the gesture, which was a token of friendship? Chavez was trying to make manifest his he's a very well-read man. He's a voracious reader. Why the U.S. press didn't concentrate on the fact that Chavez was trying to say, hey, U.S. And Latin America have a history, you should read that history, you should learn it, absorb it, and I've emailed you before. You probably don't know me. I'm working on a pseudonym. My actual name is Flavio. I'm a Brazilian living in Wisconsin. I would just like to have your thoughts on that. Why the U.S. press didn't concentrate on the significance of the gift?
Okay.
Kathleen, you may be better positioned than I am to talk about the United States media, but I think we have a kind of historical amnesia in the United States, which often is very convenient for our perceptions of ourselves, and our identities, and our sort of moral sense of self. And it's not even historical; it's often very, present tense. I can remember just in recent years my really shock and astonishment, and I perhaps was naive about this, but some of your listeners, Kathleen, will remember when the Downing Street memos were released, which really, I think, revealed a tremendous amount about the actual motivations for the United States invasion of Iraq in 2003. And there was a tremendous vacuum in the mainstream American media about that. In fact, the mainstream media really ignored it and only covered it at all, and that was barely so when it was pressed to do so by the blogosphere. And so the caller is absolutely right. There's a long history with the School of Americas. There's a long history of the United States supporting repressive regimes and overthrowing democratic regimes, frankly, up and down Latin America and in other places, including Iran. And we often forget that history when we're dealing with hostile regimes. I mean, it's very, to take Iran as an example, it's almost impossible to understand the current situation in Iran, the current political regime, and the current relationship between Iran and the United States, absent an understanding of the 1953 coup, which we basically engineered, which overthrew a democratically elected government and replaced it with a dictatorship. I think the government and the media and the public all sort of share in a desire to dismiss inconvenient facts and to have this kind of historical amnesia. And it's bad all around, but it's bad even for us because, of course, in many ways, and Iran is maybe the paradigmatic case here. You have a kind of blowback where it ultimately bites us, even though it may be comforting in the short term.
Right. Well, and as you say, I thought your points were really interesting earlier, that we've had 8 years of a different kind of policy. So something, and Obama talked about this during the campaign, that he would treat other countries with diplomacy. He would walk in where we haven't walked in for a long period of time because we're making a point that these are, members of an axis of evil. And so the press response to it and some of the Republican response to it is, oh, my gosh, how can you shake hands with Hugo Chavez when Obama has said we had this debate? The whole notion was somehow if we showed courtesy or opened up dialogue, that it would show weakness on the part of the United States. And this is new for us. We haven't seen this in a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, the conservative media and conservative actors in the American political sphere are somewhat apoplectic about all of this because it hasn't happened before. Even, the Clinton administration, I think, wasn't willing to to just make nice or even to talk in some respects with some of these regimes that we've had difficult relations with. But you often find, once again, this kind of historical amnesia. So Chavez is another example of this. I mean, Chavez has really said some pretty, outrageous and tough things about George Bush in particular and to some extent about the United States as well. So, I mean, you can look at it that way and you can say, well, we should absolutely not talk to this guy. The president should never be photographed with a big smile on his face, shaking hands with this man and everything. But to do that also, you know, conveniently forgets the fact that in the early days of the Chavez presidency, there was a coup directed against him, which was successful for about 2 days or so. And there's some argument and evidence that the United States government under George W. Bush was behind that coup. I think there's mixed evidence on that. But what is clear is that, you know, shortly after it happened, we were right out of the gate recognizing the new government, which is a profoundly undemocratic thing to do. And so there are memories, you know, there are memories for Venezuelans, there's memory in Latin America, and there's certainly memory for Hugo Chavez. And in some ways, if you incorporate some of that history, a lot of history, really a couple centuries worth of history, but certainly that more proximate history, then these things take on a whole new meaning. And you know, there's a whole new sort of understanding of why Hugo Chavez might, you know, call George W. Bush some of the inflammatory names that he did.
Thank you, Rick, very much for your call. Jim from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. In a previous call, I pointed out that deregulation doesn't work even in terms of running a busy intersection, and so how could it possibly work for a country? And it's interesting this last week that the conservatives were hitting very hard on tea parties and puffing about taxes. But I would argue that, in the main point here, that the deregulation constitutes a hidden tax inflicted upon the American people. Think about lax regulation and the billions unaccounted for in the war in Iraq, or the present financial crisis, or deregulation relating to the environment. Deregulation has inflicted health costs through cancer clusters. And finally, deregulation has inflicted costs through global warming, Katrina, drought in the southwest United States, and many fires as well. And so the overall picture is that these constitute a hidden tax. The costs of these constitute a hidden tax on the American people because we have not in the past been willing to regulate.
Yeah, I think the caller makes an excellent point. I mean, part of that I would put down to deregulation. So I think a lot of the current economic crisis that we're suffering through now is attributable to deregulation, not only under the Bush administration, but under the Clinton administration as well, who, interestingly enough, I think shared a fairly common ideology, certainly when it comes to economics. I mean, conservatives, I'm sure, you know, the veins in their temples are bursting to hear me say that, but really I think the Clinton administration was quite conservative economically, and of course so was Bush, and very favorable to deregulatory impulses, and I think that's has a lot to do with explaining how we got to where we were, or sorry, where we are. With respect to some of the other comments that the caller alluded to, and other costs, I should say, I think some of those don't necessarily get put down to deregulation per se, but rather to kind of the way that we've practiced capitalism historically, and the notion of what economists call and business people call externalities. You know, so basically, if you can externalize your cost or society's cost, perhaps to take pollution as an example, and get that off the books, then, you know, you can think about profit and loss in a way that's really divorced from reality to a very real extent. But reality isn't going away. So those environmental costs or social costs or whatever will come back to bite you one way or another. And so, right, I mean, deregulation may have saved somebody something somewhere along the line, but now we've already spent, close to $2 trillion trying to bail out the results of a deregulated economy. And you have to really think about these things in the long term and the wide perspective as well. You know, I think you have to think about who benefits and who loses beyond just a very narrow scope, and that's the way we've traditionally thought about these calculations.
What did you think of those tea parties, Professor Green?
Well, I think there's a couple questions with respect to those. Maybe the fundamental question is were they legitimate, spontaneous grassroots movements, or were they rather what some people refer to as astroturf, that is to say, fake grassroots imposed by conservative activists from above. And I think there's certain, my guess is probably there's a mix, but I would tend to lean rather more towards the second explanation. And there's certainly some evidence for this. Some of the people who run are involved in very prominent conservative groups and think tanks and activist organizations were also part of putting this together. And there's one organization that Think Progress, people might want to go to that website, that found that did an analysis of Fox News and found that Fox News did, in the 8 days preceding the Tea Party's on tax day, did 23 segments and 73 on-air promos for the Tea Party.
Oh, my.
Fairly astonishing, especially when you consider that it's before, not after the event. So they weren't reporting on it, they were hyping it. And that's a huge amount of coverage. I mean,
yes.
I wonder how many segments they did, for example, on the war in Afghanistan or on global warming, you know. And then so you have to wonder to what extent would the people, and this is probably the second big question, how many people did show up, which is disputed, to what extent would the number, whatever it was, have actually shown up had it not been rather relentlessly hyped by Fox and other outlets. And then the last question, I think, Kathleen, that's really kind of crucial about this is, you know, if you just take it at its face value, so let's say these were legitimate sort of spontaneous uprisings of angry Americans, what is it they were angry about particularly, and what is their proposed solution? And that's very much unclear. I mean, if you can discern anything from it, there sort of seems to be an anger about spending and an anger about taxes. But, you know, I mean, it's very, I think, ill-focused and sort of inchoate. And to some degree, of course, those two things are contradictory as well. I mean, one of the reasons that we have such a huge national debt right now is because Ronald Reagan and then George W. Bush massively slashed revenues by cutting taxes. And so to some degree, you can't have both unless, of course, you're willing to cut spending in some dramatic fashion. So I'm pretty dubious about the whole enterprise, I guess I'd have to say.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. We have one line open. 800-486-8655 is the number. And Mike from Appleton is next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I'd kind of like to go to your guest's opening comments with regards to, you know, the Obama administration and which way are they going to go. And, you know, we really don't know. And while I didn't vote for President Obama, he is the president, and I'm certainly willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. On the foreign policy side, you know, shaking hands with Hugo Chavez and smiling here and there for photo ops, that's fine. But at some point in time, something's going to happen and he's going to be tested. And I hope he's a centrist president. I hope it goes in that direction. And, you know, I wonder what that test is going to be and how tough he really is.
And what do you mean when you hope he has a centrist response to a foreign policy?
I guess what I mean is, I think there are a lot of enemies out there for whatever reasons. There are a lot of enemies out there. I see Iran getting a nuclear weapon, having a nuclear capability as something that would not be good for the world. I see them being in control of the Straits of Hormuz, and you know, it doesn't look good. And so my concern is, you know, how tough is he going to be with these regimes?
Okay.
Well, you know, I guess we don't know, but I don't have any reason to believe that he's a patsy or is likely to be rolled. And, you know, I don't think the history of American foreign policy post-World War II suggests that. I mean, if you want to look at Democratic presidents, for example, Harry Truman, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, these folks were all pretty tough on foreign policy issues. In fact, one could certainly make an argument, particularly, I think, with respect to Johnson, that they were too hawkish, not failing to be hawkish enough. We don't have anything, I think, really to go on with Obama, with the possible exception of the pirate case in Somalia, where, in fact, he did give the green light to the Navy SEALs to take out the pirates if the kidnapped captain's life was in danger. That was the case, and they did do that on Obama's okay. So if that's any sort of indication, that's obviously a pretty small case. If that's any indication, I think that suggests that you know, he's unwilling to be rolled. I mean, my guess about him would be that he, on the one hand, wants to come to nations, particularly those where we've had strained relations in the past, with an open hand in an incremental fashion and see what they respond with. And if they're willing to respond in a similar fashion, then maybe ratchet up the process and try to improve relations. But, you know, there were people, in fact, supposedly Mayor Giuliani, who said on 9/11 in the days thereafter, you know, thank God George W. Bush is in the White House. But it's totally inconceivable to me, and I mean totally inconceivable to me, that had Al Gore been in the White House, that America would have failed to respond to 9/11, that we wouldn't have, for example, invaded Afghanistan. I mean, there was a vote in the United States Congress about whether or not to go into Afghanistan, and out of 535 members of Congress, only one voted against that resolution. I mean, I think there's wide bipartisan support for protecting American security in the world, and nobody's going to attack the United States under a Democratic or a Republican president and not suffer consequences, it seems to me. The open question is, how do you deal with people, how do you deal with other countries in situations where that's not happening, where there's not an attack, where there's not, you know, overt military hostilities? That's a different scenario. And there I think you would see a departure perhaps between Republicans and Democrats or conservatives and liberals. But I think in conditions where there's a real genuine threat to American security, I really doubt that a Democratic president would act significantly differently than a Republican president.
What's the best course for, he's got a bit of a test going on in Iran now with the Roxana Saberi, the American journalist who's been jailed for spying. Do you imagine that there are a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuverings going on there right now? What's the best way for the administration to release her?
Well, I do imagine there's a lot of maneuvering. I don't know much about the case, and I mean, I think two key questions. One is, what is the nature of her actual guilt? Was she in fact spying? And that certainly would change the situation. And then the other key question, and this one I think we probably know the answer to, is to what degree does the judiciary in Iran act independently of the government? Is the government able to overrule a finding of guilt in a court of law? Or absent that, is it able to, you know, just strike a bargain with the United States, almost like we did during the Cold War, you know, exchanging captured spies or something to that effect. But that could be tricky, and it certainly could hinge to a large degree on where the general overtures toward Iran are going, and vice versa, whether there can be a thaw in the relationship more generally, and that may wind up being kind of a bargaining chip in that larger process.
Our number, 800-486-8655. And I request, just to make sure we have a new system for emails, that somebody send us an email. If it's a good question, we'll say it on the air, but we want to make sure our system is working here, too. So the email address is talk@wpr.org. Would you send us an email, somebody? talk@wpr.org, 800-486-8655 is the on-air number. Wayne from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Well, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
Yeah, go Brewers. To your guest, I always have to add that when I'm talking with you. A very learned man, and I respect his opinions immensely, although I disagree to some extent with his commentary regarding the Tea Party event. We had one locally here in our community. I'm from Holman, but La Crosse had one. And we had about 200 people, and I'm somewhat familiar with the organizer, and she's just an average housewife. And I didn't see Dick Armey there. And I know he's been identified, and that's okay. I mean, what surprises me a little bit, Professor, is that if something like this comes about and it may have a conservative tinge, some of you folks on the left always come up with ulterior motives. But if the left has an event, that's concerned citizens. And I see some hypocrisy, and I don't mean that disrespectfully. I'm just, that's what I'm hearing, and I don't know. I guess I just think it was a good event, and I think it was by people who care about this country. I didn't vote for Barack Obama, but I'll stand up for him any day of the week, and I'm pulling for the man. But maybe some of the concerns that maybe we're expecting government to do too much. And I'll just take my thoughts off the air, and I appreciate your points of view. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for your call.
Well, thanks, Wayne. I appreciate your kind words. I hope I'm not guilty of hypocrisy. I mean, I tried to do two things in responding to that. One was to suggest that I think there was a mix there of the grassroots and the AstroTurf, and the other was to be as factual as I could be, and so I gave you some, you know, some statistics, actually, in terms of the number of segments that somebody counted up that Fox was running on air, which I think is pretty unusual. I mean, I think you would have to agree that, you know, that Fox wasn't doing that, for example, in 2003, when there were giant marches of millions of people worldwide against the Iraq war. I kind of doubt that Fox ran, you know, nearly 100 segments hyping those protests in advance of them. I think there's probably a lot of legitimate sentiment by caring citizens in America about the direction of this country. People are really unhappy, and they should be unhappy. I mean, I think there are a lot of things going wrong. And one of those things, by the way, I mean, I wouldn't agree, frankly, in a comparative sense, either longitudinally looking at our own history or comparing us to other developed democracies in the world, I wouldn't agree that taxes are high in America. In fact, by both comparative measures, they're extremely low. But I would agree that we are running incredible, enormous deficits and compiling an incredible mountain of debt. And I do think Americans should be really concerned about that. And to the extent that The Tea Party protesters were out there thinking about that. And again, I have to say, it's not exactly clear what the Tea Parties were about. Mm-hmm. And this is an important point. I mean, that may have been their purpose, and it may not have been their purpose, and there may have been other purposes as well. But to the extent that that was the agenda, I mean, I don't dispute that that's an important issue. I also felt that way under George W. Bush, who, you know, doubled the national debt, and Ronald Reagan, who tripled the national debt. And I wish that the conservatives had been out during those two administrations, you know, I mean, here's a case of, I think, hypocrisy, talking about the effects of loading the national debt in during that time. But now we have a special case. I mean, now part of what Obama's doing is he's spending because I think he has somewhat of a liberal agenda. But a very big part of what he's doing is spending simply for the purpose of trying to stimulate the economy. It's a one-off thing. It's something that you do, you know, once every half century or something like that, when the Fed no longer can do the job, consumer credit cards can no longer do the job, borrowing against your home mortgage can no longer do the job, and China can no longer do the job. I mean, the only place right now that we can hope to come from in terms of stimulating the American economy is by government spending. It's right out of the Keynesianism 101 textbook, and I think a huge amount of that spending that Obama's doing, and also Bush did at the end of his last term, is exactly for that purpose. And it's disconcerting, but the alternative is much more frightening, it seems to me, and that is that we continue with a very depressed economy for a very long time.
Well, it also seems to me, and I wonder where this anger has gone, that there should be legitimate concern about where all that TARP money went. I still don't understand where it went. I keep asking the question. It was a huge amount of money that all taxpayers paid, and is it working? Where is it? Was that a good idea? It didn't seem as though the Tea Party protests were addressing that, and I don't think we've addressed that very fully.
Oh, I totally agree. I think this is an outrage, and it was an outrage under the Bush administration. And to me, at that time, you know, given what I understood about the administration and its politics, it was not a giant surprise. But the Obama administration, I think, has really kind of continued, with respect to TARP at least, that lack of accountability and lack of transparency. And that's a really big disappointment. I mean, I'm not the world's biggest fan of Barack Obama, but I did have much different expectations for him in this domain. And I think it's a giant outrage. And I think you're absolutely right to be angry about this, Kathleen. It's a giant outrage that that we can't know where those monies went and what they were spent on. And what little we do know suggests that the money, first of all, the former Secretary of the Treasury came to Congress and said, we need the money to do such and such. And then he got the money and he did something very different with it. But the basic selling point was, we need the money to to create some liquidity in lending in the banking sphere, and so in order to sort of free up the economy. And so all the money was given to these banks, and the one thing I think we do know is that they didn't lend that money out, which is, again, a giant outrage, and people should be really angry about that.
Well, should we have a tea party?
Well, or maybe coffee or biscuits or something, but, you know, it's... I mean, it's funny and it's ironic in a way because, you know, here we are on the heels of Obama releasing these torture memos. And so that's sort of, you know, that kind of goes to the heart of state secrets and everything. Now, my question to Barack Obama, one of many questions I'd want to ask him, but certainly one would be, why can we know about that, but we can't get transparency on the distribution of TARP funds?
Yeah, it's a good question. Let's welcome more phone calls. And thank you. We asked for our email system is working, and we have an email, and we got test emails from listeners, too. So it's up and running. If you'd like to send an email, talk at WPR.org. Keep the number in mind if you'd like to call in for all things political, 800-486-8655. Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University, is our guest. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we will be speaking with the author of Defying Gravity, a celebration of late-blooming women, recounting the stories of 12 ordinary women who did extraordinary things later in life, and that inspired by Susan Boyle, who brought a tear to my eye, I must admit. I also must admit I've seen the video probably three times, maybe four. So we'll talk about all of that. I think she's inspired a lot of people. It's quite a story. All right, let's go to an email that we have. And here it is, Professor Green. What's going on with the Republicans? Where are they going? They seem lost to me. And if you'd like to comment on McCain's daughter's recent comments.
Oh, this is a great question. I mean, this is the, in some ways, the domestic political as opposed to policy question of our time, it seems to me. The Republican Party, I think, is in a really, really difficult position. I mean, some of that is transparent, obviously. They've lost two elections in a row. That rarely happens. In 2006, they lost both houses of Congress. That rarely happens. And the party is sort of transparently in disarray. You have sniping amongst its leaders. You actually have no sort of natural leader of the or spokesperson of the party right now. So in many ways, I think it's pretty clear that the Republicans, and also if you look at kind of party identification data, people are very much trending away from Republicans and towards the Democrats or towards being independents. So a lot of that on the surface is very clear, but what's deeper down, I think, is a really fundamental conundrum for the party, which is this, basically. I think the only possible solution for the Republican Party is to move from what I see as being on the far right to something closer to the center, to become, once again, as they were before Ronald Reagan, the party of the center right. But I absolutely don't think that's a possibility in terms of where the base of the Republican Party is right now. So I think the party has kind of made this bargain with the base that that now it's unable to escape from. And so the base demands, I think, that the party stay to the far right. At the same time, ironically, that more or less consigns the party to unelectability, seems to me, outside of, you know, perhaps the South and maybe still a few Rocky Mountain states. Even some of those are being peeled off. So they really, I think, are in very deep trouble in a very kind of existential way for the long-term, perspective. I mean, it's not inconceivable at all to me that, a couple decades down the road that the Republican Party could disappear or become, and this has happened, of course, we had the Federalist Party, we had the Whig Party, or become a kind of regional party, which isn't a serious player at the national level. I don't want to predict that. I'm not predicting that, but I would say it's not inconceivable. And the reason that I say that is just to reiterate what I just covered, which is that what is the solution to their problem? I mean, I think the only solution really is to move kind of to the center and become more electable in that fashion. But I think they're really captive of a base, particularly social and religious conservatives, who will not allow that to happen. That may change over 5-10 years. And if you look at the Conservative Party in Britain, for example, that sort of happened. And what they kind of did was sort of kind of walked a little bit towards the center, meanwhile waiting over a period of 10, now 12 years, for the Labour Party in government to, you know, wear out its welcome. So that may be a strategy. It's a pretty poor one, but that may be a viable strategy for the Republicans. You simply wait for the Democrats to, you know, get corrupt, to blunder, to alienate the public after, you know, 2 terms, 3 terms, and then you're the only alternative that's around. But that's a really weak strategy, and it doesn't really deal with the fundamental existential problem I think the party has, which is that, you know, it is a far right party. There's just no getting around that, and the public is not a far right American public, especially now. I don't see how they solve that fundamental problem.
Let's go to Jill from Madison. Hi, Jill.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, David.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Great to hear your voice getting
likewise,
out to all
thank
the
you.
WPR listeners. I have a comment and then a question. And my comment is, we don't hear this side of what's going on in Somalia, and I'm just wanting to say I'm aware that foreign ships have been dumping toxic waste and illegally fishing off the coast of Somalia for probably 12 to 14 years. And despite the Somalians' efforts to try and get somebody to address this, no one has taken any notice. And so, of course, it's ruined the fishing for the fishermen there on the coast, some of whom I assume are not to pardon it, but some of them are probably the ones that are the pirates now. And my question is, can you comment on the UN conference on racism in Geneva, where so many Western countries, including New Zealand, Australia, United Kingdom, Germany, France, etc., are boycotting the conference?
Yeah, nice to hear from you. Jill and I are old friends, and it's good to hear from you again. I used to live in Madison, Kathleen.
So,
right. I don't know a lot about what's going on. That story's breaking now about the UN racism conference, but I suspect what it has to do with is the old question of Zionism and racism and the previous conference that I think was in Durban, South Africa, that the United States and some other countries boycotted over that issue. And so even though things have changed at the UN and I think elsewhere in the world, in some ways for the better, in some ways for the worse, I suspect that's what's going on. But I guess I should probably be careful because I haven't read a lot about that case just yet.
Okay. And her comments about toxic waste dump off the Somali coast?
Yeah, and again, that's something I know almost nothing about. Certainly that would not be the first instance of environmental depredation and a situation that rendered people's lives and livelihoods very difficult at best, and could indeed compel people to commit crimes and do other things when they had simply no other choice. So again, I wish I knew more about that, but it certainly wouldn't be the first time something like that had ever happened.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Jill. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political, and we go next to Scott from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. You know, as a late bloomer myself, I could really bring a tear to your eye and sing my question, but I won't. And I've got two questions. First of all, I thought I remember hearing at one point, and it couldn't have been too long ago because he hasn't been in office that long, the Obama administration was trying to organize some kind of a conference, a regional conference of everybody who was a neighbor or involved in Iraq and maybe Afghanistan, which of course would include Iran. And if in fact, if you know what's the status or what's going on with that, I'd like to know about that. And if such a thing is being planned, I guess my secondary question is, would it be beyond the scope of the imagination that as a magnificent gesture on the eve of the conference, the Iranian government would at that point release Roxana Saberi? You know, I mean, you could. I mean, I almost see set up here. You know, it's kind of like, this she's a pawn in the grand game.
Again, that's something that I've not heard of, but what may be news to many listeners is that I think the Iranians would be very much willing now, and they certainly were in the past, to be of assistance to the United States with respect to the Afghanistan situation, and arguably in some ways maybe with the Iraq situation. That's much more of a mixed case, but of course Iraq was, you know, a longtime enemy of Iran, and nobody's probably benefited more from what's transpired since 2003 in Iraq than has Iran. But the Iranian government was also very hostile to the Taliban in Afghanistan and made an offer to the Bush administration to try to be very helpful about that, which was an offer which was mostly rejected by the Bush administration. But I think I don't know if there's a multilateral conference. I hadn't heard that. But I think clearly Iran could be helpful on many fronts to the United States. And if the United States and Iran were able to reach some sort of rapprochement, which I think is really actually doable in many respects. I mean, the Obama administration and the theocracy in Iran have rather different politics, but then so does, you know, the Chinese mm-hmm. government and the United States government, and we have a fairly, you know, good and decent relationship there.
We are out of time. Thank you so much, Professor Green.
Kathleen. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for us. Professor David Michael Green, our guest. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production, and thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll return following the news.